Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Good to have you all with us. You listen to the Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA FM 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we are about to begin Soundbites, our weekly look at the farm and food system of the future and the present. And also on here on Delmarva Public Radio, on Delmarva Public Radio, WSCL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. We're going to look at coffee towards the end of the hour, but we're going to start by talking about these new regulations that affect farming, chickens, manure, growing grain, and more. And what does it have to do with you? Well, you're about to find out. We are here this hour with Doug Myers, who is a Chesapeake Bay Foundation scientist. Good to have you in studio, Doug.
All right, thanks, Mark.
Thank you for coming in. Kathy Phillips joins us. She's the Assateague Waterkeeper. Kathy, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
Royden Powell is Assistant Secretary for Resource Conservation for the Maryland Department of Agriculture. And Royden, good to have you back with us again as well. It's been a while.
Good morning, Mark. Thank you for having me.
And Kevin Anderson's with us, President of the Maryland Grain Producers Association and grain farmer at Wimberley Farms in Princess Anne, Maryland. And Kevin, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me on today.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages, Mark Steiner, Mark Steiner Show page, or tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So these regulations that were going to go into place that would regulate where and when you could put manure, chicken manure where on fields. And people go, oh, no, we're talking about chicken manure again? Why? Well, and what does it have to do with us? And so, but the state, Department of Agriculture, and Governor Martin O'Malley decided to postpone those regulations because the poultry industry said it would we're not prepared to address this. And the study itself said that 80% of the fields in the Lower Eastern Shore and 50% statewide were saturated with phosphorus, and those were going into the bay, and we have not come to grips with controlling it even after all these years. So it was, but it was postponed. So before we get into the heart of what this means and what the real issue means, that 26% of all the phosphorus going in the bay comes from chicken manure. And my question was what about the other 74%? Where does that come from? Which we'll talk about in a moment as well. But Royden, tell us why the pushback on this from the beginning.
Mark, this is moving forward. This process forward is something we've been involved with for all of 2013. We initially proposed regulations back in January that would implement the latest level of science from the University of Maryland. So we had moved through that process. We had reintroduced the proposal in July and an emergency proposal, having already been through public comment. And there was a great deal of concern from the farm community about the unknown impact of this new proposal. So there were also questions from the environmental community about questions about how the tool would be implemented and the need to clarify certain aspects of that implementation. So with those two concerns, the administration, the department, pulled that proposal from AELR late in August. So since then, we've had the opportunity to sit with key representatives of both the ag industry as well as the environmental community and come up with a proposal that addresses both of those concerns, and we can talk more about that. But to be clear, the department is moving forward with this consensus agreement, and we have now reintroduced the regulatory proposal back to AELR to promulgate these regulations.
So what is it? Let me ask you both your perspectives and what this consensus. I'm sure go to Doug and then Royden. What is this consensus agreement that you've agreed to, or have you?
It's basically one of the hang-ups we had was the University of Maryland document, which is incorporated by reference into the statute, says certain things about what should be done. It's a guidance document. It's not a regulation itself. And it rests within the shell of the regulatory language that has a slightly different idea on what should be done if your phosphorus measures high. And so we had raised some concerns about inconsistencies between what the regulatory guidance document said that came from the University of Maryland and the shell regulation that it was embedded within. And so that created some need for us to engage early on through the commenting process. Most of those got fixed before the rule went out for comment, but there were still some things to move out. So that was what the environmental community brought. And I think Royden mentioned there was some concern from the regulated community about how this would be affected. There's certainly not a lot of data right now as to how many farms would be affected, and so very hard to do a complete cost analysis on this new regulation when you don't know exactly how many farms will be affected.
Kevin, what about from your side?
Well, it's been portrayed to us that it was a chicken manure issue, Mark. And as it's filtered down through the ag community, and our crop advisors have looked at the issue, it is far more reaching than just poultry manure. It goes into vegetable production with farmers that are using commercial fertilizer. It has far-reaching effects on the dairy farms in central and western Maryland. But it gets down to the everyday farmer using commercial fertilizer in their operation also. And I guess we need to step back and see how we've gotten here, Mark. And when we step back and look at how we've got to these phosphorus-enriched soils, for about 50 years, the Maryland Department of Agriculture, since they've been in existence, 40 years coming up, and Maryland University of Maryland have encouraged application of phosphorus to farmland because they called it a soil bank. And they preached to farmers for years not to be concerned. Phosphorus did not move. You can over-apply phosphorus to your land, and you have no environmental concern except erosion. So for 40 or 50 years, the farmers have been under that practice because they were, the scientific community had ensured us that it was no problem. Since we've been digging into the water quality issues of the bay, it has become apparent that we have a soluble phosphorus problem in these highly enriched soils. Since that has become a concern to the agriculture community, because remember, phosphorus is money, we have been working toward going away from what I would call a manure disposal practice that we had in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, and gone into more of a manure utilization practice that has actually lowered these phosphorus levels. But these phosphorus levels that were enriched in the 60s, 70s, and 80s will take 100 years to deplete. And we were doing that under the graces of guidance from the same people today that are turning around and firing bullets back at us, telling us that was wrong.
the contradictions are in a wash in contradictions here. Clearly, and I want to get to the bottom of this, because I think it's really important. I think it raises some very larger issues as well, and I'm glad you point out what you just did, Royd. And Kathy, so given what everybody has just said, how do you perceive this?
Well, obviously, I'm coming at it from the perspective of the water and our waterways, I'm sorry, is it Mr. Anderson from...
Kevin Anderson, who's president of the Maryland Grain Producers.
Kevin,
yes.
Hi,
yeah.
Kevin. Okay. You know, Kevin makes an excellent point, that there has just been too much of this spread on Delmarva for too many years, and now we're reaping the problems. But all of that being said, we are where we are right now, and There is certainly in Worcester County and in Somerset County, the land is phosphorus saturated. And so the reality is you just can't put more on there, or we're going to start having real serious problems up here in our waterways. I always like to refer to the St. John Riverkeeper down in Florida and the Jacksonville area. And normally you don't think of that area as, being agriculture, but it is with all of the orchard groves that are inland and upstream. And they have such an algae problem down there. Now, granted, they have urban impacts too. But he's been raising the warning flag about it, the St. John Riverkeeper, for many, many years. And it's only just now that when they have waterways that are so clogged with algae that boats can't even get up and down the waterways without clogging their intakes, that now they're trying to figure out what to do about it. And obviously, I don't want to see that happen here. And I'm glad that we have both the agricultural community and the environmental community really coming together at this point and realizing that we have a looming crisis on the horizon, and let's get a handle on it now.
Mark, if I might, there is a dynamic to nutrient chemistry that is at play here, that both with nitrogen and phosphorus, you can add a lot to the system without seeing a change. And then suddenly you're going to cross a threshold where you do have explosive algae growth and loss of dissolved oxygen as a result of its decomposition. Likewise, as you reduce the loading of nitrogen and phosphorus, it takes a long time until you reach the downward threshold of where you're no longer causing that problem. So we oftentimes, through our policies, those ag policies that were encouraging the use of phosphorus were to improve soil health, to increase yields, which phosphorus will do. And at the time, there was not a water quality problem that was signaling that practice was dangerous. We've gone over that threshold now and will be into a decades-long reduction need in order to do that from all the different sources, ag, stormwater, septics, all of them.
So let me ask you all this kind of question. This is kind of a broader question, I think, that kind of begs some questions here that I think are important. And I think because, I've been covering this issue for the last 20 years here on the air. And I've seen this issue and the change we've gone through and the arguments back and forth. And the arguments and discussions really in the last 20 years have not changed that much, from my perspective, just listening and talking and whether it's farmers, environmentalists, ag officials, whoever that may be. And so when you look at the fact that as I said earlier, 24%, 26% of the phosphorus in waters that's kind of destroying the waterways comes from this manure, the chicken manure and farming. So where's the other 76%? And part of that is in what you were just alluding to, which is the sediment where all this stuff exists in the dirt already.
Exactly.
Over the years, we're saying this is lovely to use, and now we're saying, oh, no, it's not so lovely to use. So, but that every time it rains, whether it's in a city or in a rural area, this all washes into the waterways.
One of the reasons Baltimore City's stormwater utility fee, otherwise known as the rain tax, using that name.
Let's not get into the rain tax today, please.
But basically, the reason that those fees are so high is because stream restoration projects are being proposed in order to stabilize the sediments that have been washing out from these flashy stormwater runoff off of impervious surfaces. That is liberating fine sediment particles that have phosphorus absorbed to them, creating slugs of new phosphorus loading every time it rains. That's where the 76 or so percent is coming from. This phosphorus management tool that we're talking about today is really designed to deal with dissolved phosphorus that is getting close to groundwater because of its application on land and its accumulation in the soil. It's a different form of phosphorus.
So we're talking about, Royden, something that if this went into effect in the future, we're talking about what goes on from now, not what's already in the soil. So in all due respect, let me ask this question to the four of you. So is this on some levels, when it comes to runoff and the way our agricultural system works today and what's already in the soil, Royden, is this like kind of shifting chairs on the Titanic? I mean, are we really?
No, not at all.
Tell me why not.
To the point we were just talking about the majority of the phosphorus coming from soil erosion, that phosphorus which is attached to the soil particles. We've made tremendous strides in implementing conservation practices on farms in Maryland. So whether that's by virtue of no-till farming, where we plant without tilling, or whether we have adequate cover on the ground to prevent that soil from running downslope when it rains, those are the major pathways by which phosphorus can get into our waters. The regulations that we're talking about apply specifically and only to those farm fields that have 150% of the phosphorus that the University of Maryland says is necessary for a crop to be produced. So we're targeting this regulation to those fields that have those very high P levels, and then looking at other site characteristics and management, that together the tools, these tools evaluate the risk, and then we make management changes or application changes according to those risk levels. So it's a refinement. We're continuing to recognize, you know, the value and the progress that we've made in conservation tillage, in preventing erosion, and we're taking, as Doug says, our next level of science to this now, this dissolved phosphorus issue, and better understanding how phosphorus can move across the soil profile or down through the soil profile, and with these new tools, reduce that risk of phosphorus loading to our rivers and streams.
And
Kathy,
Mark,
go ahead. Let me go to Kathy, then we'll go over to Kevin. Kathy, go ahead.
Well, I just want to point out that, you know, there's an 800-pound gorilla here in the room that we're still not really talking about. And that's the fact that we still have a massive amount of poultry manure that's produced on Delmarva every year. And by virtue of what we've been reading in the newspapers the past couple of weeks with you know, the agricultural community, especially the poultry growers, concerned about what are they going to do now with this manure that can't be put out on fields that they were applying it to previously. And we have Secretary of Agriculture Buddy Hance assuring the farming community that the state of Maryland will take the manure from them, the excess manure that they can't use, and stockpile it on state lands if that's what he has to do in order to keep it from piling up on the growers' property or, you know, inside their manure sheds to the point where they can't keep it stored, covered any longer. And, you know, this is the real issue that we need to talk about. I mean, there's the regulations are there to help prevent any more phosphorus-rich fertilizer going down on fields that are already phosphorus-saturated. But that doesn't solve the problem of the massive amounts of manure that's being produced every year by this industry on Delmarva, and what are we going to do with it? I mean, I hope that we're not going to end up having mountains of it stockpiled on state lands throughout the state. So there's got to be a much larger discussion of if this industry is going to continue at the rate that it is, and if we're going to continue to grow crops that use the nitrogen but don't use the phosphorus, which is what our corn and soybean crop growing industry is on Delmarva, where is the rest of this manure going to go? And that's a discussion probably for another show.
But I think you're right. There are a number of 800-pound gorillas in the room, and I think that's one of them. You were about to say what, Kevin, to that?
Well, what alerted the agriculture community to this? And we keep talking about the manure, but trying to educate myself about this before I came on today, I talked to a friend of mine that's in the tree care business, and we have naturally phosphorus, what they are considering phosphorus-enriched soils on the shore. And we can go in the forest. And there have been soil samples taken out of a forest that have never had poultry manure or commercial fertilizer applied to them. And under this new guideline, they would be considered in this enriched phosphorus category. And that is a major concern to us as in production agriculture. And my friend that's in the tree care business said, I can go take a soil sample out of someone's yard that their tree is suffering because it is phosphorus deficient. But when I take the soil sample, the soil is high in phosphorus. So under these new regulations, this person would not be able to apply phosphorus to his tree to help it get out of the condition that it's in because he has phosphorus-enriched soil, but the phosphorus in the soil is not plant available. And that is the science that the ag community feels that we're missing in this link. What Royden said, it's a work in progress. And that's why we were against the emergency implementation of it, is it's a work in progress, and we don't understand it right now in the scientific community, plant-available phosphorus versus soil-bonded phosphorus that's not available to the plant. We're getting better at it. It's, like I said, it's a work in progress.
But so the question I have, though, and what you're just saying here, Doug, and then Roy, and everybody jump in here, and Kathy as well. But so if it is a work in progress, but then what Kathy was saying is also real about the kind of over the excessive amounts that are produced.
Well, the excessive amounts that are produced under a utilization program can adequately be applied on Delmarva, but it's through annual soil testing, it's through buying the right equipment to apply the small amounts that are needed, it's getting the GPS and the variable rate technology on your farm to do this. It's also about adequate storage and storing it properly to prevent runoff while it's stockpiled. There's a lot.
So
I have about 4,000 acres of I plant about 4,000 acres of crops a year in Somerset County. I apply about that 4,000 acres. I can apply about 650 acres of poultry litter to my 4,000 acres of crops. So I'm not a poultry grower. I'm not involved in poultry production. But just to put a figure out there to you, Mark, that if I had to replace that 650 acres of poultry litter on my corn crop with commercial fertilizer, it would be an out-of-pocket expense to me of $150,000. And if I did not use that manure, it would be a cost to the Maryland taxpayer $40,000 to transport that away from here.
So,
only one little farmer.
I got you. So I'm going to hear some responses to what you just said. Doug, why don't you start off before we go back to...
Yeah, I mean, Kevin's right. Is definitely, phosphorus worldwide is a limiting nutrient. People are going into bat caves to mine guano and digging up the Everglades to get gypsum out of the soil so that they can have phosphorus. It is a very...
So chicken manure is not enough.
Chicken manure is not the only... we just have an overabundance of phosphorus in this region because of the chicken farming and the other agricultural legacy there. And it is this legacy issue. It's a matter of an available and natural important nutrient for crop growth that we just happen to have in abundance. And so when you have variable soils with variable legacy levels of phosphorus in them, as well as water tables that are sometimes very high and close to the surface, where you have the potential for it to migrate, it's a matter of distribution to the right places. So, yes, the state is already involved in a manure transportation program. The Purdue company put together a pelletization plant to be able to concentrate the stuff and sell it again as a manure based fertilizer for commercial purposes. We are definitely aware of and concerned about the economics of this and how it will affect each of the farmers. One of the things that Royden and the folks at Department of Ag are considering as part of this new rollout is a phase-in procedure where we'll run the old phosphorus test and the new phosphorus test side by side for a year to be able to look at which farms are now subject to the regulation that weren't before, so that we can kind of tailor the responses. Do we need to put more of the money into manure transport? Do we need some additional storage sheds? Can we work to create the markets for the manure that is currently over-applied so that we can even out this economics a bit? It's difficult because we have, like Kevin said, been using this under ag policy for the purpose of increasing production for many, many years. It's created the problem that now we have to comprehensively fix by looking at the entire system, including the water quality, and how do we address the water quality through the wise management of this manure resource.
We have to take a brief break. We're going to come right back to conclude this conversation for the next 10 minutes here on Delmarva Public Radio and WEAFM in Baltimore, here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show. We'll come back go directly to Kathy Phillips with a question, since she raised an issue earlier and how that fits into what we've just talked about. Stay with us.
For 37 years, WEAA has been serving your community, bringing you innovative programs that simply aren't available on commercial radio. Listeners like you have supported WEAA for all those years so that we can be here to serve you today. Now it's your turn to support WEAA so we can continue to serve your community tomorrow. Please call 443-885-2075 or give online at weaa.org. And thanks. Support for WEAA is provided by Soulful Symphony, making its return to the Hippodrome Theater stage for the 2013-2014 season with artistic director and Morgan State alumnus Darren Atwater. For Say Amen Somebody, an annual tradition that brings the community together in celebration of gospel arrangements on Saturday, September 21st at 8 p.m. Ticket information available at 410-547-SEAT or Ticketmaster.com. And members like you. Thank you. Supported by the U.S. Forest Service and many other national organizations, Get to Know has launched a nationwide contest for youth from ages 19 and under to get outdoors and share their nature-inspired experiences through art, writing, photography, video, music, and more. Rediscover the great outdoors and connect with nature. For more information, gettoknow.ca.
John Tegler here, inviting you to the world of real jazz. Yes, it all happens on Jazz Straight Ahead, celebrating its 29th year on WEAA-FM, the voice of the community, on Wednesday evenings from 8 until midnight. Join us, won't you?
This is Deborah Owens, author and financial expert, bringing you your Wealthy Minute. Instead of throwing out some damaged clothing, repair it instead. Don't toss out a shirt because of a broken button. Sew a new one on with some closely matched thread. Don't toss out those pants because of a hole in them. Put a patch of some sort and save them for times when you're working around the house. Simple sewing can be done by anyone. It just takes a few minutes, and it saves a lot of money by keeping you from buying new clothes when you don't really need to. And that's how you nickel and dime your way to wealth one day at a time. For more tips and tools, visit DeborahOwens.com and listen to Wealthy Radio at 7 p.m. every Tuesday right here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Wealthy Minutes are funded in part by a grant from the Investor Protection Trust. www.investorprotection.org.
Welcome back to Soundbites here on the Mark Steiner Show on both Marvel Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM and WSTL 89.5 FM. Of course, right here at our home station, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We are here in the studio. We're not in the studio. We have one person in the studio, but they're all here with us. Kevin Anderson, who's president of the Maryland Grain Producers Association and a grain farmer at Wimbley Farms in Princess Anne, Maryland. Royden Powell, assistant secretary for resource conversation with the Maryland Department of Agriculture. Kathy Phillips is an Astig waterkeeper. Doug Myers, a Chesapeake Bay Foundation scientist. And before we jump, I was a question I wanted to raise, which is a larger question out of what Kathy just said. You said something to me during the break, Doug, which I think that has bearing on what we're talking about here.
Yeah, Mark, you had mentioned early on that you've been talking about this issue for 20 years, and it doesn't seem like anything's changed. And I think what has changed is since 2010, the EPA has been under what's called the Total Maximum Daily Load Pollution Diet, Chesapeake Bay Blueprint, whatever you want to call it, a mandatory structure that affects all the states in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, and it allocates loads of phosphorus, nitrogen, and sediment to each state, to each sector, stormwater, septics. This is regulatory. This is mandatory. This is requiring change where all of our previous Chesapeake Bay agreements have been mostly handshake and mostly good ideas, good good practices that some people would adopt, but for the most part were not regulatory. As we move to this regulatory system, it's going to hurt. It's going to affect lots of people. It's going to cost some money because we can no longer just pass it on to the next generation. We've just seen over the weekend that EPA's the lawsuit that was filed against the TMDL back in 2011 was upheld by a federal judge. The EPA has been deemed not to be overstepping its boundaries. The state watershed implementation plans are enforceable, and we're in this era where everybody's got to...
beyond the state of Maryland, we're talking about.
Beyond the state of Maryland. This is all, you know, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia, New York, Delaware, West Virginia. Anybody who's in the Bay watershed has got to do this.
And now developers for the first time are going to have to account for...
Accounting for growth is the next new policy coming in Maryland where any new loads need to be offset, and heretofore those have been added as we're trying to reduce loads elsewhere.
So farmers have been crying forever that other sectors of the economy do not take their fair share of responsibility to any of this.
There's going to be no escaping it now.
So, but Kathy Phillips, you raised an issue earlier, and we have about 10 or so minutes left in the segment, and I want all of you to kind of jump in on this particular issue. And there was a report that people heard on Morning Edition talked about farming and the future, where farming really is, and that farmers are trying to produce food as efficiently as they can and cheaply as possible with as high as yield as possible, but that most food grown in America doesn't go to food, but goes to either ethanol or goes to other things and sending it overseas, and that is, and whether it's soybeans or grain or whatever that is for animals, whatever that is. So I'm saying that very quickly just to get to the point. So the question is, can this issue of phosphorus and manure in our area here really be addressed ever in a meaningful way, Kathy Phillips, and then turn to Royden Powell, in the agricultural system as we have it now? Can it really? Are we just kind of keep arguing this, but can it really change?
Well, it's going to have to change at some point, and that's just the reality of it. There's... When I spoke earlier about we have to start finding other ways to deal with the waste product that comes from the poultry industry on Delmarva rather than just spreading it on the fields. And, you know, Purdue took an initiative a number of years ago to build the AgriCycle plant where they recycle the manure into pelletized fertilizer. But the reality is that the AgriCycle plant isn't it. For instance, over about an 8-year period, I think from 2001 to 2009, the plant handled about 1.3 billion pounds of manure. But actually, the industry on Delmarva, the whole poultry industry, not just Purdue, but Tyson, everyone else, produces 1.3 billion pounds annually on the Eastern Shore. And according to Purdue's website, only half of the fertilizer that Purdue manufactures is used outside of the Bay watershed. And when you were talking about the transporting of this manure, the manure transport program ideally is supposed to, all this state money goes to transporting the excess manure outside of the watershed. But, you know, we have, for instance, the industry itself is using that taxpayer money. Well, Purdue, in fact, got about $1.9 million since 2009 from taxpayers to move manure, and much of it's from their own birds, and it moves it to its AgriCycle plant, but then it's actually profiting from the fertilizer that it's producing at the plant. So, you know, I think we really need to take a good, hard look at what are the resources out there, how can they be better managed, and instead of always going back to the state, and which means the taxpayer, funding all of these Band-Aids in some cases and really good programs in other cases, you know, where is Tyson, where's Mount Air, and where's Purdue in all of this? It's their birds that are creating the waste. Why are we paying to clean it up?
Royden Powell, your shot.
Mark, I think we have solutions in hand. I think folks have talked earlier about the amount of land that exists, not just in Maryland, but actually on the Delmarva Peninsula, to appropriately utilize the volume of poultry litter that's being generated, primarily on the lower eastern shore. The very good news about poultry litter is that that material has value. Its highest and best use is as a crop nutrient. In addition to the nutrients, it has organic matter and other micronutrients that are beneficial to crop production. So there is the potential, and we've been realizing that potential, to redistribute it. That's where part of the answer lies. So whether it's by virtue of its market value or whether it's by virtue of the range that we enhance with our manure transportation program, we can redistribute that material to places that can use it appropriately. This animal agriculture industry is key to Maryland agriculture, and it's key to local economies. So our solutions then have to work toward maintaining the health and viability of those local economies and do that in a way that's environmentally protective. In addition to transportation, we're also making investments. I'd like to talk just a second about how we're exploring other uses for this material, the alternative uses. The state this year is investing $2.5 million in new technologies that we can deploy on farms that find alternative uses for manure. So whether that's poultry litter or whether that's dairy manure, how can we take this material, generate energy from it, generate heat, for example, to heat poultry houses, and reconfigure the nutrient analysis of the byproducts so that then we have a fertilizer material that we can better manage based on its nitrogen and phosphorus content. So we're moving forward to receive proposals this year to demonstrate, to put on the ground those demonstrated technologies that can, you know, help us meet goals of manure management, improve water quality, and perhaps increase farmers' energy independence.
So we have
Mark.
Let me just say before you jump in here, Kevin, we have like literally two and a half minutes left in the segment. So let me let you have a thought here on that.
Well, first thing, unintended consequence that may be important to your listeners, and I'll move fast here, is under the organic agriculture. Maryland has spent a lot of time and effort in building an organic organic agriculture industry. They rely on utilizing organic sources of manure. Under this plan, you would probably bankrupt most of the organic farmers in the state of Maryland. That's an unintended consequence of this phosphorus management tool that has to be reworked.
And let me just, because we're almost out of time here, I do apologize, Kevin, but I'd like Doug, a final thought.
Well, you know, Kevin, I think it's important that we wait until the actual soil tests are run and the new phosphorus management tool is applied before we can say who will or will not go out of business. I think Chesapeake Bay Foundation has always said a well-managed farm is one of the best land uses for improving water quality for Chesapeake Bay. And I think that applies to both the small organic agriculture. We ourselves have our own organic agriculture farm in Maryland that we test a lot of these things. And I think we've even offered to the Department of Agriculture, if you need to store some chicken manure there, we'll probably make a pad for you. So I think it's a matter of getting the manure distributed the right places, valuing that phosphorus and that organic matter that are important as organic nutrients, and protecting the bay. We don't have a choice. The bay needs us to be able to protect its water quality from all of our land use practices, and I'm looking forward to how the phosphorus management tool will allow us to do that.
So I think that this is we're just touching literally the tip of the manure in some senses. I was going to say iceberg, but it doesn't fit our climate in addressing this conversation. There's a piece that just came in I was alluding to about what happened on Morning Edition. I'll just read it and just leave a thought and see if this is something we pick up on next time. It's not necessarily real, but let's look at it. It's a new report that played on Morning Edition explores the tension between high-tech agriculture, damaging the environment, and delivering food, with the imperative to feed the world. Farmers are trying to produce as efficiently and cheaply as possible with a high yield as possible, but much of the food grown, especially the grain, isn't going to feed people. 40% of the biggest crop, corn, goes to fuel cars, and most of soybeans goes to taking care of our animals, chickens, and others. Can we solve the problems of phosphorus in the bay without really talking about larger issues of agriculture and where agriculture is going? And so I think that is part of the dilemma. I think we should just kind of wrestle with honesty together because we want farmers to stay on the land. We want food on the table. And we want the water to be clean. And so we'll come back to this with our guests, all of whom are concerned deeply about this. Kevin Anderson is president of the Maryland Grain Producers Association and grain farmer in Wimbley Farms in Princess Anne. Kevin, it's great having you on. We look forward to having you back.
Thank you, sir.
You were great. And Royden Powell, always good to have you with us, Assistant Secretary for Resource Conservation for the Maryland Department of Agriculture. Royden, always good to talk to you.
Thank you, Mark.
And Kathy Phillips, Assateague Waterkeeper, always a pleasure to have you on the air with us.
Thanks, Mark.
Always. And Doug Myers, Chesapeake Bay Foundation scientist.
Thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
We're going to take a brief break here on Soundbites here on the Mark Steiner Show and turn our attention to coffee and coffee collectives. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show here on Soundbites as we explore the future of our food system here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Marvel Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. And the Mark Steiner Show, and we are here in this part of the Mark Steiner Show with Kay Sim Keel, who's a collective member and founder of Thread Coffee, which we've been drinking a lot of around here lately. Good to have you in the studio.
Thanks.
And join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jump onto our Facebook pages and let us know what you're thinking. So welcome to the studio. Good to have you here.
Yeah,
so,
thanks for having me.
This is an issue that people talk about all the time between, there are all these incredible local companies that we know in Salisbury, Maryland, here in Baltimore, Maryland, that are doing their own coffee, roasting their own coffee. So, first describe to us why. What is the big deal between, okay, we can go to Starbucks or we can go somewhere else? What's the big deal?
Well, I think, first of all, it's really good to operate on a local level, so supporting local businesses. So roasting coffee locally helps create jobs here, and doing that as a collectively run worker-owned project also is a part of creating a different model here, economic alternatives to the current model that we have, and also just helps to get people to have access to fresh coffee. Coffee, when it's roasted fresh in small batches, just tastes better.
So how does that – so talk about what Thread Coffee is. I mean, what do you mean when you talk about having a democratic collective that has a coffee business? What does that mean?
So Thread Coffee is a collective that is a part of the larger Red Emma's family of projects, and there are four members. And what that means is that the four members of Thread all meet together and everyone has equal decision-making power. So anytime we decide on where we're going to get a new coffee from or how we want to roast one, that's a decision that each person involved in working in the project gets to decide on. And we operate on a consensus model. So everything that we decide goes back to the larger collective with Red Emma's as well. And all of it kind of operates on principles that we believe in.
So, I mean, how does that tie into how and where you buy your coffee and what the coffee is that you're bringing to the rest of us?
Yeah, so we like to call what we do transparent trade because we're working to be really transparent in how and where we're getting the coffee from. So we work with a couple of farms, for example, in Chiapas, Mexico, some farmers there but that are part of a group called Maya Vinique, which comes from a group of folks down there that are known as the Las Abejas, which they have historically been oppressed. And through growing coffee, we kind of, in buying their coffee, we're able to act in solidarity with them and support what they're trying to do, which is basically stand up for their autonomy from the Mexican government and live in a way that they believe in. Additionally, you know, we're working to get coffee that is grown in a way that's good for the environment. I think it's really important, you know, to look at how, you know, the growing of coffee affects things like, you know, are they clear cutting land and using a lot of chemicals on the coffee? A lot of the cheap coffee that you find, that's how it's typically grown.
So what does that mean for us as consuming the coffee?
Well, it's not going to have a ton of chemicals in it, so it's going to be a lot better for you. It's going to taste better. You can feel good about, you know, buying coffee that is supporting communities, supporting the environment, and also supporting workers. So every step of the way, people are getting paid a price that's fair for the coffee, you know, from the person who grows it to the person who's roasting it to the person who's brewing it in the store.
So that's interesting. So, I mean, so the folks who grow this in Chiapas, Mexico, who are, I guess, are native Mexicans, native people, how do they grow their coffee that's any different than any other people growing their coffee? And besides the political issue of helping a group that wants to be autonomous?
Well, part of it, it's a part of their culture to actually interact with the environment in a way that helps to preserve and protect it. So, you know, the coffee is shade grown. It's grown in a way that allows for other plants to grow with it, which is good for the environment, good for the soil, you know, different growing practices that they use that allow them to not have to use fertilizers and chemicals. And it's just grown on a lot of small farms. So it's, you know, by families rather than, you know, one wealthy estate holder who has lots of people working on the farm. It's a lot of smaller groups.
So now we know a lot of farm CSAs exist. People have CSAs and they put so much money in, they get food back. But this is a coffee CSA.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that work?
Well, we're calling it community supported coffee. And the idea is that you can pay up front for different sizes of shares of coffee. You can either get 1 pound a week or maybe half pound a week or 1 pound a month. And you then get it at a discount based on how much you're getting. And each month we have a different coffee and it'll come with information about that farm and
Different kind of coffee beans?
So different kind of beans, yep. So either like a coffee from Mexico, a coffee from Colombia, a coffee from Ethiopia. And those we each roast to how that particular coffee tastes best. And giving us that upfront money allows us to invest in the project and help get ourselves off the ground without having to take out big loans from banks and things like that. So we're trying to get creative in how we're funding this project, along with Red M's in general. And it also just is a fun way to get to have interaction with the people drinking the coffee.
Tell us before we run out of time, how do they get in touch with?
You can visit threadcoffee.com or email casey@threadcoffee.com.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great meeting you. And we do like your coffee here at WEA. We appreciate you bringing it by so folks here can enjoy it.
Thanks.
Casey McKeel is collective member and founder of Thread Coffee. Good to have you in the studio.
Thanks.
Thank you. I remind you as we go to this break that the Mark Sanders Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com. We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, one of our weekly recipes here on Soundbites.
Sciorilli tutto l'anno, l'amore capita, stipi lo tondo, sciorilli tutto l'anno.
My name is Sam Levin. I'm a senior at UMBC studying information systems. For high school, I attended a Carver Center for the Arts and Technology in Towson, and there my prime or specialty was culinary. I got to work with a lot of cool chefs in Baltimore, so that's sort of like inspired me to keep going with this as mostly just a hobby. So what we're going to try to prepare here today is spaghetti aglio e olio. It's a big change of pace from just pasta and red sauce. Basically, it's really, really simple, and that's the point. The only ingredients that you really need are spaghetti, olive oil. Olive oil should be something of an investment since that's sort of a main component. Cheaper olive oils have a bitter taste to them, usually. A nicer olive oil tastes maybe more fruity and smooth. It doesn't have any sort of harsh aftertaste either. And then you're going to need like crushed red pepper flakes, Italian parsley, not curly parsley, and a bulb of garlic.
So you already started some of the prep. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you did here already?
You have to make sure to, like, you know, pick the parsley from the stems and give it a wash, and then you got to unwrap each piece of garlic.
So you have a handful of parsley picked from the stem, 3 cloves of garlic peeled.
Yeah, it also depends on like how big the cloves of garlic too. I never break my spaghetti. So I usually cook with a taller pot and I fill it up maybe halfway or almost all the way. But you know, just enough water that like you push the pasta down as it when it gets up to a boil. You should add enough salt to make the water taste pretty salty.
For this recipe that you're going to make right now, how much of the box are you going to put in?
I'm going to throw in like a half a box. After you get the water boiling, you should prepare your garlic by cutting them into pretty thin little hockey pucks. You want to cut the garlic lengthwise from the pointed end down to the base and to relatively thin slices that way. Just slice it up like that. Depending on how much you're making, it's really up to you. I really like garlic, so I'm probably going to throw in maybe like a whole tablespoon. While you're bringing your water to boil, you're going to fill up your saute pan with a decent amount of olive oil, enough to cover or coat your spaghetti. You're going to keep it cold. You don't want to turn on the heat yet. And in that same time, you're going to also add in the garlic. Because you don't want to burn the garlic. The point is not to burn the garlic, but to like lightly cook and toast it. You're going to cook the garlic in the oil until it becomes just browned. You can even taste it if you want to make sure that harsh raw flavor is gone. And the olive oil should get some of the flavor of the garlic, and the garlic should get some of the flavors of the olive oil, and it should really mellow itself out. You just want to keep an eye on it. It's going to start sizzly bubbling, like very slight bubbles. You don't want it to start frying the garlic. So while you have your garlic and the olive oil on a low heat and you're trying to get your water up to a boil, you should prepare your parsley. With that, we're just going to mince it up pretty normally. It's just going to go onto the pasta. The Italian parsley is a good contrast to the really nutty, mellow flavors that you're going to produce with the olive oil and garlic. So after about like 4 minutes, the garlic on a pretty low heat should be sizzling very slightly. You know, it should be a nice golden brown. Once you feel like the garlic is about to just be golden brown, like it's just about to be ready, you can add in enough crushed peppered flakes to make it as spicy as you want. After you throw in the crushed pepper flakes, just give it a little stir. Keep an eye on it. Once you have the water at a boil, you're going to throw in your spaghetti. Some people time their pasta. I'm more by taste.
So you turned off the heat when you noticed that a lot of them were getting brown.
Yeah, when they start to get golden, you should turn off the heat. And you want to throw in anywhere from, depending on how much oil you have, a couple tablespoons to half a cup of the starchy, salty water.
And why are you doing that?
Throwing in the spaghetti water, it stops the garlic from overcooking. After you strain the pasta, you're going to dump it in with the saute pan where the oil was cooking. You want to toss your spaghetti in the garlicky oil sauce. You want to get the garlic all mixed in there. And you can eat these pieces of garlic. They shouldn't taste bad. I mean, as long as they're just slightly gold. After you toss the spaghetti in the oil, then you can go ahead and add in your chopped up parsley. You want to portion it off into a decent bowl and serve it up to your special someone. Yeah, thank you so much for joining me.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. And for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.